They've made a series of power meters that you can connect directly to the port on a computer. The good news is they get ridiculously great accuracy and lots of frequency region. I think the bad news is they're a bit pricey, though. I wonder if you're familiar with those, Mike. WY2U, KQLIW in the TechNet.
No, negative. I'm afraid I am not there, Dick. Is this a new product of theirs? Because, no, I'm not familiar with that product line at all. Sounds like it might be new. Go ahead.
Yes, I think it is new. I think they've come out with it in the last year. But they've got a couple of very nice power detecting circuits you can plug directly into the port on your computer. They're powered by the computer, and they give the indication directly on the computer. But they're kind of pricey. I think they're in the multi-hundred-dollar category. Great accuracy, but not the kind of inexpensive ham equipment that I think Joe is looking for. It's a good project you got there, Joe, and as you can tell, there's many ways of doing it. And now your problem is there's so many ways of doing it. You got to choose the right one that's got the right accuracy slash price and frequency range and dynamic range and so on. There's an infinite number of ways of synthesizing any electronic circuit. It's a good thing to remember. Next person on our list was Andy, N2HUH. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz, Andy. N2HUH, K2IW in the TechNet.
Did you finish the last guy as far as his TV antenna question went?
A double check. John, have you gotten enough answers on the questions you had with your TV antenna? KD2IXP, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yes, I believe I have enough information to do a little homework and make an appropriate choice. Thank you.
Okay, so once again, N2HUH, K2RIW, go ahead.
Good evening, Nick in the TechNet. No, you didn't put me to sleep. Maybe a couple of glasses of wine later. At worst, but I'm doing well. My question would be regarding my 35-year-old or so butternut all-band vertical that I've used in two locations now. It's been installed now for the past, since 1998 at this location. And I do have a 20 by 100 lot. And I have all my ground radios mounted on the cement, basically, on top of the cement. I have nothing really on the ground except the DC ground. And I was wondering if there was any efficiency or improvements that you can think of that I can implement in this ground-mounted all-band vertical.
My impression, Andy, of a quarter wave like ground plane radio, ground plane, vertical ground plane antenna, is that having the right number of ground plane radials sort of guarantees you're going to get the radiation efficiency you're looking at. If you've got too few of them, a significant amount of your RF energy gets coupled into that volumetric resistive material called earth. And you're heating up the worms in the wintertime, but other than that, some of your RF energy is being wasted. You put down enough ground plane radials, that problem goes away. And what if the ground plane radials are buried 6 inches in the ground, 0 inches in the ground, or sitting up on top of a thin layer of concrete? In my opinion, that doesn't matter. That ground plane, let me backtrack now. In the case of a dipole in free space, at one instant of time, the right side is positive, the left side is negative. You could put an infinite sheet of metal at right angles to your dipole, right down the middle, with a small hole in the middle where the dipole goes through, if you know what I mean. But you put a vertical, an infinite sheet of metal at right angles to your dipole, nothing changes. You don't change the impedance, you don't change the gain, you don't change the pattern, everything's the same. Once you accept that it will work with that infinite ground plane in that location, you can decide to throw away the left-hand side of the dipole, feed only the right side with reference to that infinite sheet of metal. And you get the exact same performance in that hemisphere. If it was an infinite sheet of metal, you're shielding yourself from one hemisphere. But in that hemisphere, you're getting the same performance. And so when you decide to throw away half the dipole and feed it with reference to the sheet of metal, you now call it a vertical ground plane antenna. So the individual radios that we put down, if they're tuned to the particular band and they're a quarter wavelength long, they act a...
Repeater, timeout.
Each of those ground plane radios that you lay down, if they are electronically a quarter wavelength long for that particular band, then it gives you 98% of the performance of an infinite sheet of metal. The antenna can't tell the difference if there's enough of them. Because your antenna covers multiple bands, the usual way of doing it is to make sure that the ground plane radios are long enough for the lowest band. The fact that they're too long for the higher bands doesn't matter. Don't worry about that. There are people who think you've got to lay down ground plane radios for 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters, and 15 meters. It is my belief that that's not true. If you've got enough ground plane radios down for the lowest band, you've got the ground plane radios down. You're trying to simulate an infinite sheet of metal for that original mental diagram I just gave you. So now, the one other thing you ought to put in the back of your mind is that if at some later time you decide to buy or build a kind of antenna where the radiator is electronically a half wavelength long, at first you say, you're going to say to yourself, whoa, if my antenna is 35 feet now high, and I'm going to make it, instead of quarter wave, I'm going to make it a half wave, does that mean it's going to be 70 feet high? Remember I said electronically a half wave. If it's electronically a half wave by way of tuning devices, coils, top outloaded capacitors, zigzag, helical windings, and whatever, let me drop. If the radiator is electronically a half wavelength long, and you're feeding the outer end of that dipole-like structure, instead of feeding 35 ohms, which is what you're feeding with an ordinary ground plane, you're feeding something like 1,500 ohms. When you're feeding 1,500 ohms, you've got to use some kind of an impedance matching device at the point where you're feeding it. That's a little bit of bad news. But the good news is now, if you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance, a half wavelength radiator, as opposed to a 37 ohm impedance if you're feeding a quarter wave radiator. In the case of the quarter wave radiator, you've got to lay down enough ground plane radials so that the radials give you an impedance to Earth that is very small compared to 37 ohms. You'd like that to be 3.7 ohms. Well, in the case of feeding a half wave radiator where the impedance is 1,500 ohms, you're now looking for your ground plane radial system to be in low impedance compared to 1,500. 150 ohm resistance would do the job very nicely. Therefore, you're going to get 95% of the performance with nothing but a grounding rod. You don't have to put down radials, per se, if you decide to feed a halfway radiator. So, if you buy or build a kind of vertical antenna that's a half-wave radiator, life gets a lot more simple if you want to go that way. It may become a little bit more narrowband, and maybe it's not going to give you the amount of bandwidth you like without a pretty enthusiastic antenna tuner. Okay, back to you, Andy. N2HUH, K2RW in the tech net.
Okay, I got the idea. So the only thing I'm toying with now is that, say, the longest radial I have is, let's say, 50 feet long, and the only way I can get anything longer is down my alleyway to in front of my house. So if I took a 120-foot piece of wire and just went down the full length of my alleyway out to the front of the house in the L configuration, and now it's 120 feet long, I can only do it in that one direction. Should I bother? I guess you can't have too many, so I guess an extra long length radios wouldn't hurt anything. I'm just looking to fine-tune it, especially if it's being used on 160 meters.
Yeah, that's a pretty stiff requirement. A vertical ground plane radiator on a 20-foot by 100-foot piece of property, and you want it to do a good job at 160 meters. Anything you can do to make that radiator a half wavelength electronically would give this benefit that I just discussed to make it a quarter wave, assuming your butternut is a quarter wave vertical antenna. I don't know, but maybe it is. And if you're only able to lay down a few of the ground plane radios because of your property, and you have trouble making them long enough, you are going to get some degradation in performance. And it's a degradation in performance that's hard to confirm with ordinary instrumentation is a problem, Andy. That is to say, when you're coupling some of your RF energy into the earth because of not enough ground plane radios, those ground plane radios, when you lay down 32 of them in the extreme case, you've got those ground plane radios at least a quarter wavelength long, if not longer, and by 32 of them, they're all so close together that the RF energy cannot squeeze between them. It's like if you lay down copper screening on, say, a parabolic dish antenna, and you worry about the size of the holes between the wires of the copper screening. Let me drop it. And as long as all those holes are very small compared to a quarter wavelength, very little of the RF energy will feed through. The wind will go through it, but the RF energy will not. But obviously, as you go to higher frequencies, you've got to use finer and finer screening. Well, that's sort of what you're doing with the ground plane radials in this particular case. And so when you've got spaces in between your wires, because there's not enough of them, some of that RF energy is coupled into the earth and it's heating the earth. And you can't measure that by way of your standing wave ratio meter, by way of your directional watt meter. The only way you could really confirm that some of your RF energy is going into the earth is to do a total radiated power assessment. In other words, you're walking around the antenna and making a whole lot of field strength measurements. It's not easy. But maybe we're worrying unnecessarily. If half of your power was coupled into the earth because you don't have enough ground plane radios, that is not a showstopper. It just means you're 3 dB down, in my example. If it's half the power is going into the earth, and that means you're half an S unit down on a well-calibrated S meter. You're still going to be talking to people, just that in a pile-up you might not do as well. And you can make up some of that by way of using a high-power amplifier. Because when it comes to antenna efficiency on most of these HF bands, receiving doesn't matter. You can use an awful low-gain antenna for receiving, because if the antenna is inefficient in the receive mode, let me drop it. It means you see less of the signal you want to listen to, but you all see less of the atmospheric noise. The signal-to-noise ratio stays the same. Quite a few of us have done the experiment of taking a random length of wire, you know, a clip lead, and connecting it to nothing but the center conductor on the UHF connector on the back end of a HF receiver. And you don't get a whole lot of S-meter deflection, but the guys you listen to sound equally as good, if you know what I mean. You cut down the signal, you cut down the noise. The bottom way of looking at that is, you could say your receiver is amazingly forgiving, but you are now, the questions you're asking, Andy, are really, what kind of antenna efficiency am I going to get with this compromised ground plane radio system? And there's ways of measuring it, there's ways of estimating it by way of computer modeling programs, and there's a way around it, and that is to switch over to a kind of antenna where you know the radiator is a half wavelength long. As you dig into this deeper and you find out more about what's going on, Andy, please come back and let us know what you find out. N2HUH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2YO with comments.
Go right ahead. Boy, I'm terrible on names tonight.
Bernie.
I had him on my list. Bernie, you know who you are. Go right ahead, Bernie. Give us the real information on this one.
I was just going to recommend poke around the NRRL website. Either QEX or QST had an article, this is probably about 5 or 6 years ago, a gentleman out west that has some space set up a live testing range for this, number of radials, and I believe they also got into asymmetrical radials and came up with some real good data. So see if you can find those articles, two or three articles.
Hey, your transmitter was going into its squealing mode, Bernie. So we heard all your words, but at the end the squeal was getting louder and louder. this article, what is your rough recollection? That is to say, as he skimped on the number of ground plane radials, his efficiency, his radiated efficiency went down, but I bet you it went down to numbers like 50 and 25%. It wasn't a complete showstopper, is my guess. Is that roughly the data you remember, Bernie? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LAW and the TechNet.
I believe that his acceptable range was something like 8 or 12 radials, or 12 radials of
substance. So I think you're saying, I'm going to put numbers on it now, he was getting 85 or so percent efficiency when he only had a few of those radials down. And even when they were off to one side and he was skimping on them, he was still getting reasonable radiation efficiency. But how was he rating the radiation efficiency? Was he really doing far field field strength measurements? Is that approximately the way he confirmed the performance of Bernie? K2YO, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
It's been a few years, but I believe he was using far field measuring. He was sitting on a couple of hundred acres of open, though he had the kind of space.
If we're doing a Google search or we're doing a web search for this particular article, what's your best guess? What's your best guess as to what we should use as search words? Over to you, Web Bernie.
I think I'd use something like how many radios for a quarter wave ground plane, and then put QFT in it or QVX in it, just so it makes light.
If you guys are hearing things that shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode, and whatever you hear, your signal strength and the time that you heard it, please go to limarc.org, and there's a particular web page where you fill in the information. So if you're hearing things that you think shouldn't be there, go to the reverse mode, measure the signal strength, and then please report it to arrail.org. Okay, so as you can tell, it's not clear. The antenna doesn't suddenly stop working, Andy, when you use too few radials. And the worst example we know of is the so-called Herbie Snake antenna. This was a 20-year-ago experiment. One of the Limarc members had a very stiff landlord that wouldn't allow him to put up any antenna. So he literally laid pieces of coax cable flat onto the lawn and made it radiate on 20 meters. And we ran a series of experiments with him. Yes, his signal was a couple of S units weaker than a guy who had a real antenna, but he still was on the air. So, and you can make up the difference when it comes to talking to people during a pileup by using a high-power amplifier. N2HUH for any other questions or comments or fills. K2LAW and the TechNet. You got it, Andy.
I'd just like to thank Bernie for submitting that suggestion in QEX, and thank you, Bernie. And, another question would be, when I get 2 inches to 2 feet of snow on top of my radio system, does that mean this is my big opportunity to have closer to 100% efficiency, or is that actually a negative when I get, or absolutely meaningless when I get the 2 inches to 2 feet of snow?
Yeah, I'm one of the few guys who've got actual experimental evidence on this one. And it all came about because I was reading this article in the newspaper where they said that a person moving to Florida is going to go through a culture shock, and the chances of him being happy right away is as likely as a snowball in a microwave oven. Well, it was a winter day, and I did the experiment. I put a snowball in a microwave oven with a 6-inch, with a 8-ounce glass of water, ran the microwave oven full blast, 700 watts for 60 seconds, and the snowball did absolutely nothing. I did some further research to find out what in the world's going on. Water in its liquid form has a huge dielectric constant, dielectric of 81. very few materials are that high, and it's a huge loss factor. It absorbs RF energy like the hammers of hell and turns it into a heat right away. Water will do that. Ice is an entirely different material. When you go from water in the liquid form to water in the ice in the solid form, it goes from a dielectric constant of 81, it jumps down to a dielectric constant of something like 2 or 3, and it becomes an extremely low-loss material. The bottom line is that snow, as long as it's a small number of wavelengths at your frequency, for instance, if you're using it at 40 meters, 40 meters is 120 foot is a wavelength. Your snow is never that thick, if you know what I mean. The snow is almost transparent to RF energy, Andy. Ain't that crazy? Your antenna will behave the same as if the snow isn't there. Now, and the next piece of example of evidence I've got on this one, let me drop it, is that arguably one of the world's best antenna ranges that was that I was using for a couple of years at the Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York. It consists of two mountains a mile and a half apart with a nice deep valley in between the two, and they set the airplane up on a pedestal 50 feet high in one mountain, and they got a whole bunch of high-gain antennas on the other mountain, and they squirt signals at it and make very precise measurements. It's an extremely good full-size aircraft antenna testing range, and I worked there for a little bit more than a year. They got the best performance out of that antenna range on a minus 20 degree day when there was a foot and a half of snow on the ground. The foot and a half of snow where the signals are hitting the ground at a grazing angle, they got less ground reflection on a snowy minus 20 degree day with a foot and a half of snow. That's where the antenna range gave them the best performance. And the difference, by the way, is fairly small. The bottom line, as you can tell, is snow and RF energy is a very friendly combination. For the most part, it ain't there, Andy. N2HUH, I bet you're surprised by that one. K2RIW in the tech net.
Well, yes and no. I thought about it briefly, and because if I'm using insulated wire, it's not actually contacting the snow at all, but of course it melts, and maybe it is making contact, and it starts getting soft and on. But I guess if you have it you have your radios in dirt and it rains, possibly when the snow melts, that you might have a little bit of a pickup there in your ground system. But I notice when it rains, my resonant frequency does drop. In frequency, it actually goes lower, but most of my radios are on top of concrete with only a couple of short ones in the dirt and the DC ground in the dirt. So I'm wondering why it actually does change that dramatically much. I guess it's just that's because of the soil itself, not because of conductivity with the radio system.
Yeah, that's a good guess, and that's not an easy one. On the next transmission, Andy, you're going to tell me how much it changes. I mean, did your 80-meter frequency resonance go from 3.75 to 3.70? You know, is that the kind of motion you got? And the gradials that are in the earth, and the earth now gets wet, yes, it's got a different dielectric constant, a different toning characteristic. But for the radios that are insulated wire sitting on top of concrete, I don't think you're getting much of a change on those. That's my guess. Also, you've got to be concerned about the fact that the water running down the actual antenna itself, and maybe it's gathering just the bottom insulator, the main insulator that feeds the antenna. Water getting in there could make a change real fast as far as resonant frequency is concerned. So how much resonance, real shift in kilohertz on a particular band did you see, Andy? N2HUH, K2RIW in the TechNet?
82DQI.
Let me see if I have it. Okay, assuming it was operating, everything was resonant and proper, I think on one band, and I can't recall, I'll have to check my notes, but I believe one band actually, I think it was a lower band, between 160 and 40 meters, actually dropped almost 100 kcs in resonant frequency. And I do want to mention my ground-mounted vertical is actually 3.5 feet above ground. had 3.5 feet of snow, I'd still be in business. And that's because it's sitting on top of a chain link fence, so that's where my low point has to be. It's using a chain link fence network as part of the system also. But I think it was as much as 100 KCs, which I thought was a little disturbing, but I accounted for that when I was centering the frequencies and all, and it still tunes up and loads up with no problem. That's what I get when it rains. And I do recall when it snows, it does change in resonant frequency also, but I don't know by how much. I didn't document that yet.
D2DQI. 82DQI, pick you up in a second. So when the snow comes this winter, it'd be interesting to document that, Andy, how much it does shift. And it would sure be nice to find out, is the shift because of the radials that are on the concrete? I think not. The radials that are in the ground, I think they could be affecting it, and whether or not water is getting into the base insulator. 82DQI, I wonder, do you have information on the subject that's on the floor right now, or are you signing in for a later question that you want to be put on the list? 82DQI, please start off with your name. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
DPZ is here.
Well, nice to meet you guys. It's Kilo, Nickelback, India, and I have some knowledge on a subject. I'm Jay, and I'm transmitting from Fort Schuyler, New York. All right, back to you, Dick.
Okay, you said you've got some information on the subject. Why don't you give us your information on the subject? Go ahead. And what's your name? Again, did you say it's Jay?
That's Jason. I go by Jay. I'll just butt in and, yeah.
Okay, you said you've got some information on the subject. Please give us your information right now.
I was getting static on the way up here. I didn't hear the last information in context. Can you just repeat it?
DPZ is in.
Okay, we're going to go over to Hal. K6DPZ, I wonder how much information you have with butternut or verticals, Hal. And I am guessing it's a quarter wave, not a half wave type radiator, but correct me on that. K6DPZ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, I want to say hi to everybody on that also. Well, I think Andy's full question. I just walked into the car. Butternut antenna is a quarter wave. It's a very scantily made antenna. What is his main problem? I didn't get that when I got in the car. I heard him pretty much signing off. Give me a little synopsis. Maybe I'll give up a few, some quickie answers.
Yeah, there's sort of two questions he's got. Number one, he sees 100 kilohertz or more of shift in resonant frequency on the lower bands when it's wet, when it rains. On top of that, he wonders how marginal his performance is because he's only got a 20 by 100 foot piece of property, and many of his ground plane radials are sitting on top of concrete, and many of them are not the full length because of his skinny piece of property. He can't really lay down the ground plane radials quite the way he wants to. And the base of the antenna is sitting on top of a chain link fence. It's not really mounted at ground level. So maybe all of this tied together. He's trying to ask us, What do we believe is his radiation efficiency with his marginal ground plane radiation system, and what's possibly creating the shift in resonant frequency on a rainy day? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
IW in TechNet, K6DPZ. Okay, the situation is with that antenna, it's very highly loaded, which gives it a very sharp Q. Being that it's a sharp Q, any small change in capacitance, like moisture or anything else is going to move that antenna around, Dick. That's number one.
Okay, and where he's only got a small number of the ground plane radials down and they're not the full length because of the layout of his property, is there any easy way of estimating how much loss in efficiency he might be getting? Over to you, Hal.
Knowing the base impedance of the antenna, I can't really tell you. Got standing wave on that line, that's definite. He has to measure the base impedance of the antenna, which I gave a lecture a while back on LIMARC, how to do it very easily with a grid dip meter and a RF probe on a grid dip meter, a resistor, and an RF probe on a Fluke digital voltmeter. You can measure the base impedance. By that, he could know how his efficiency factor is because of his mismatch characteristics. Go ahead, Dick.
To his case, Hal, where you and I might have a difference of opinion, if some of the RF energy, first of all, the standing wave ratio of an antenna is strictly a function of what is the value of the, what is the quality of the impedance match between your transmission line and the antenna. And now, the antenna itself, depending on how you impedance match it, it could be a 20 ohm, a 50 ohm, a 37 ohm, whatever. Knowing the number of ohms does not tell you where the RF energy is going, how much of it is going into space, how much is being coupled into the ground. There is no easy way by making an impedance measurement on an antenna to find out how much is being coupled into the earth. It takes other external measurements like field strength measurements. Total radiated power is what we're talking about here. And in the most, in the general case, I don't think you can confirm that by base impedance. You might differ on that one, Hal. K6TPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Really, Dick, base impedance is one part of it. Also, the aperture of the antenna enters into it also as far as radiation, field radiation. But you have to start somewhere. So I would say first start and see if you have a halfway decent match. So you're driving that antenna from the base with the most power possible into the antenna to get, you know, the base impedance. It's not the only factor, though, Dick. I agree with you. I've worked with broadcast stations for many years.
And even though his antenna resonant frequency shifts and the standing wave ratio changes, if he's got a broad enough antenna range on his antenna tuner, and if he's got low enough feed line cable, that becomes somewhat of a wash. With a good, well-made antenna tuner and low loss cable, almost any impedance can be matched, and a high amount of the power coming out of the transmitter will be delivered to the antenna. That's an opinion. Not everyone agrees on that one. There's a hell of a lot of people who think that any reflected power from an antenna simply gets eaten up by the antenna tuner and thrown away. I strongly disagree with that one. An awful lot of people believe it. Okay, we're going to move on because we've got two more people on our list before we go to the mailbag, and it's getting a little bit late. The next person on the list was N2XJN. And if I understand correctly, you really wanted to know a little bit more about how the two signals can flow in opposite direction on a transmission line and not couple to each other. They're thoroughly isolated from each other. I think you wanted some more words on that one. Is that true, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, that is because I found that many people are confused with what's going on there. They cannot understand that why the reflected and transmitted signals don't see each other. Now, when also another factor is the hot spot on the coaxial cable. I can jump. For me, the most interesting is the photon deposition of its energy in form of the heat. But that might be a little bit too much to the first hour of conversation. And to again.
Yeah, where you live in Queens, Wes, there's a tremendous number of broadcast stations within a few miles of your house. Manhattan, for instance, and a hell of a lot of others. What I'm getting at is there's all kinds of signals at all kinds of frequencies. Those signals are drifting through the air in your living room. Some of those signals are going north to south, east to west, high frequency, low frequency, all of those radio signals going through the air of your living room or the air above the roof of your house have absolutely no interaction with each other. Those signals pass through each other with no interaction in that three-dimensional transmitting media called air. When you boil that down to a one-dimensional transmitting media called coaxial cable, or twin lead or waveguide, the exact same thing happens. The fact that some RF energy is flowing between my transmitter and the antenna, and if the antenna does not match the impedance of the transmission line, a predictable amount of energy will be reflected from the antenna. Let me drop. The signal that's reflected from the antenna travels back down the exact same piece of cable. The fact that the signal coming down is literally traveling through the signal that's on the way up. Both are happening simultaneously. For the most part, there is no interaction between the two. The only time that you create an interaction is in the case of a slotted line. You put your probe down into that slotted line. You move the probe on its carriage along the Z-axis of your slotted line. And in certain places, you see a high voltage. In other places, you see a low voltage. And the ratio between the two, we call it standing wave ratio. What the probe is doing, the probe that you've got down in your slotted line, is a non-directional probe. It mixes together some of the signal. It adds together some of the signal that's going up the cable and some of the signal that's going down the cable. And depending on where the probe is located, those two signals are either in phase and you get a peak in signal, or they're out of phase and you get a valley of signal. So the probe is the place where you added the two signals together and created an interaction. There is no interaction on the cable itself. Your directional coupler can independently measure the signal going up, ignoring the signal coming down, and it can measure the signal coming down and ignore the signal going up. And you can run that directional coupler with two completely separate signal generators, one on each end of that cable, on each end of that directional coupler. And the directional coupler that's looking for the signal going up, so to speak, you can turn the dial on that signal generator up and down and watch the indicated power on that coupler in that direction go up and down, and you can at the exact same time turn up and down the other signal generator, and there will be no effect. That's one pretty strong piece of evidence that those two signals are independent of each other. Let me drop. There is a catch to this, though. Obvious by the fact that your probe on your slotted line will find peaks and valleys of voltage, and you could use a different kind of a detector where you see peaks and valleys of current. There are certain places on the line where the current going up and the current coming down happen to be in phase most of the time. And there are other places where they're out of phase. In the places where the currents going up and down are in phase, the line will run physically hotter in that area. You could use a thermal imaging camera and you could look at the hot spots on the cable. If you're putting 100 watts or 1,000 watts to the cable and there's a reasonably high standing wave ratio, certain portions of the cable will run hotter because of the higher current giving more I squared R loss on the center conductor. Let me drop. And depending on what your dielectric material is in the coax cable, if it happens to be polyethylene, which is a little bit lossy at very high microwave frequencies, polyethylene starts becoming kind of lossy at, let's say, 1 gigahertz. So if you're running a whole lot of power at 1 gigahertz, there are certain places where the voltage going up and the voltage coming back down are in phase, and therefore you see a higher voltage in that point. That's what your slotted line measures. You will see more heat in that place if it happens to be due to dielectric heating. So by way of the heating effects that you get, you can easily come to the conclusion that, gee, there is evidence that the signal going up and the signal going down are mixing together. They're interacting with each other. You can easily come to that conclusion. I disagree on that one. I say that they're not. And the best examples I can think of are other physical things where you can actually see it with your own eyes. And that is, you drop a pebble into a puddle of water. And you drop the pebble into the north side of the puddle, and you'll see waves traveling to the south. Let me drop. You drop a pebble into the south side of the puddle, and you'll see waves traveling to the north. Now you drop a pair of pebbles into the puddle, north side and south side, and you'll see those two sets of waves fold through each other with no interaction. As long as the waves are small enough that there isn't the time linearity of white cap, so to speak, you'll see those waves fold through each other with no interaction. Most linear transmitting medium, whether it's a wave traveling on water, whether it's a pulse of energy traveling down my guy wire of my tower, or whether it's a radio signal going down your coax cable, most linear transmission media act that way. The signal going from left to right and a signal going from right to left do not see each other. They're thoroughly independent events, even though in the case of standing wave ratio, the upgoing signal and the downgoing signal really started off on the exact same frequency from the exact same signal generator. They still are independent events. And it's a whole bunch of opinions based on a whole bunch of measurements that I've seen, and a lot of people will disagree with me. I'll admit that this is a controversial subject. But once you accept that concept, let me drop. Once you accept that concept as being mostly true, then you suddenly have a mechanism for mentally coming up with a model, a mental model, of how does a directional coupler do its magic? How does a quadrature hybrid do its magic? How does certain kinds of phase-sensitive antennas, like a phased array antenna, how does it do its magic? To really understand each of those components, in my belief, you have to accept the concept that the signal going left to right and right to left in the transmitting medium are independent events, and they do not interfere with each other as long as the signals are small enough that you're not arcing over the cable, if you know what I mean. It's a concept, it's a mental model. For me, it works. As you can tell, it's a little bit controversial. Not everyone will accept it. In 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much for that. I'm not going to drag it. Usually I keep the repeater busy in this area, but I'm satisfied with the answer. And 2XJN.
It's a good question, Wes, because among the electronic engineers with radio experience that I have talked to over the years, only a small percentage of them have come to that conclusion, have accepted that concept. And unfortunately, the guys who don't accept it are the guys who really don't believe a directional coupler works. They don't believe a quadrature hybrid works. They don't believe certain kinds of phased array antennas work. They just say, yeah, there's some kind of magic going on there. I don't know what's going on. So a learning curve. There's a whole lot of magic going on at the atomic level with many of the circuits that we deal with. And transmission lines, they may look simple as a schematic diagram on a page, but what's really going on in there, there's a little bit more than meets the eye. And one of the guys who's doing quite a bit of experiments along these lines, sometime with his dual directional coupler, his dual slotted line, a Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line. Rarely does a guy these days have one of those. And there's a guy in Staten Island named John who has down to his last two. He's got a pair of them, and he can cascade them and do all kinds of crazy measurements. Let's see what he's been doing. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John, with your question.
Yes, Dick, it's a lot of fun. And good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Good to have all you guys around. You know, Dick, I did start to make a directional coupler with this slotted line, and I got some interesting things. We'll touch that sometime in the future. A lot of fun slotted line, and more people should grab them. And it's not too difficult to build one yourself. And all you need is a meter stick and some way of mounting the probe, and you can have a lot of fun with that. All right. I think I'll have to save my question until after the mailbag, Dick, because we're running kind of late. It's 10 to 10 already. Is that right with you?
It's your choice, John. And lucky for you and me, we're quasi-retired people. We can stay up late enough, and therefore we can discuss this later. Okay, so we'll go over to the mailbag now. We don't want to keep the people who are really enthusiastic about the space report. Don't want to keep them waiting too long. So go ahead with the mailbag, and let's see what kind of challenges you got from those guys this week, because sometimes they give us some pretty tough questions. We make jokes about the fact that when you stump the TechNet people, you get a great big meal at your favorite restaurant. I'm not quite sure how we're going to finance that one. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Well, Bernie volunteered to pay for that one, Dick. KC2WG. All right, let me drop it. Go on to the first one.
The Bernie with the whistling transmitter? He's the guy that's going to finance it? Good old money bags, Bernie. Fantastic. Go ahead, John.
Okay, I have a question in the chat room from a gentleman who's looking for some information that somebody may have. Hey, Joe, if he's still around. He's looking to buy a dongle to plug into his computer that'll operate at 1 gig, and it may come with software so he could use any information on brands or where he should look and how he would pursue that. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Now, maybe the expert in that one is Lou, NY2H. He has, over the last year or two, bought a number of dongles, hooked them up to computers, and made very good receivers out of them, and it became a so-called Green Sky Project. I wonder if Lou is available, and what Lou is doing with his dongles on Green Sky, do you believe that comes close to what your questioner is asking, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I know Lou is familiar with dongles. The application with Green Sky, which I have one here that I use, I'm also on that program. I don't think that's the same thing, but Eric might know also if Eric's around.
I heard my name.
Okay. John, please repeat the question for Eric's purpose, just in case you didn't hear it. You got it, John.
Yes, I will. Good evening, Eric. A gentleman on the chat room has a question. He's looking to purchase a dongle. And like it to operate, he needs it at 1 gig, and maybe with software to help him interface with the computer. Any names or where he should go to check that, and how would he research that? So I know you've got a lot of experience with that, so I'll pass it over to you. Pick it up, Eric. KWGB.
KW2WGB, K3J. Well, the question is, it's kind of obscure. It's like, what is he calling a dongle? Because it sounds like he wants a memory stick where he can just plug it into a USB port and have additional memory. Dongles, when we tend to use the word dongles, it usually has a specific function. Like for years, when you mentioned a dongle, it was a security device that would unlock the software that you would buy. And lately, the RTL-SDL, the receiver is not a stick. A lot of people are calling them dongle too, so... what is really the question, or is it unclear to you?
It sounds like he wants a 1 gigahertz receiver. Maybe he wants to be able to demodulate and measure signal strength, and maybe look at the spectrum of 1 gig. Is that your guess as to what he's asking? Over to you, John.
That's how I believe, Dick. I follow your thoughts. I believe he's looking to, as a receiver, and I guess he's calling it a dongle receiver at 1 gig. And with software to do, probably maybe he wants to look at waterfall or something like that. So back to you, Eric.
Yeah, maybe he wants a poor man's spectrum analyzer at 1 gigahertz. Over to you, Eric.
Okay, the answer to that question is actually quite simple. You go on eBay, and you look for, you put in SDR, right? RTL-SPR, that's a good way to start. And you'll find a whole lot of manufacturers selling these dongles that are really intended for digital video broadcast in Europe. Actually, European standards, some of them actually will even demodulate the European standards of digital television. And there's different models of them. And if you type in Google, RTL-SDR, it'll bring you to a website that actually has a program that operates that thing, quite modular, in fact, that you can add things to it. You can actually record a whole segment of bandwidth. Say you could be listening from 100 megahertz to 150 megahertz, record it, and then play it back and tune any way you want. It provides you with waterfall. It gives you all sorts of really neat stuff, and actually... that is the basis for the program that you're using in the Little Blue Sky project. So, K2RW, K2J.
Now, what are these devices that gives reasonable coverage, reasonable sensitivity at 1 gigahertz? The actual piece of hardware, before you add the software to it, roughly what are we talking about here, Eric? Is it in the $100 category? Over to you, Eric.
By the way, gentlemen, he's looking, now he just dashed over, it's an HF-SDR receiver. That's the that's what he's looking for, Eric.
And QC said.
All right, HF, that's just a different issue, okay? there are folks out there that sell these little up converters that essentially take from, I think, the 100 kilohertz up to where the dongles usually start, which some of them will start at about 30, some of them start at 40, depends on which model you get. Some of them start at 50. There's a bunch of converters out there, so basically you set yourself up with the basic setup like everybody else has. And by the way, there's decoders for DMR and P25 and all sorts of neat stuff. It also does sideband. There are different plugins. People are actually writing plugins for this SDR system. And, doing a little investigating. Oh, by the way, Dick, I bought mine. It was $12. I use it for ADS-B, which is the aircraft transponder, which is 1.6 gigs. So it gives you a little bit of an idea of where these things will go. Just don't forget, it's got no front end, so be wary in terms of that. You know, be conscious of it. You've got something 100 megahertz away that's, you know, coming down the pipe at, say, minus 20, it's going to whack you out. And if you're listening, you know, 100 megahertz away, it don't matter. K2RW, KU2EJ.
Todd, good information. I thank you, Eric. Looks like Bill's going to give us some more information because he's been using these things, I'll bet you. WB2QGZ, the microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RW. Go ahead, Bill.
And you're using WB2QGZ. So, I did, it's sort of interesting. I did a Google search for RTL-SDR. First thing I found was a relatively inexpensive, a little bit bigger than a memory stick-looking thing, where the whole unit just kind of had a USB on it, and it plugged into the side of the computer. And I had a really hard time getting that thing to even really be recognized or function well with the SDR Sharp, the software, which works pretty good. The next one along, I think it was on Amazon, actually, was a small metal box. It's maybe 3 inches by 1 3/4 inches. And that has two spigots on the top, one for HF and one for UHF, VHF. And that's the one I'm using for most of my stuff here. Used it a little bit at HF. It seems like it works. And the V and the U up to wherever the highest I've probably looked has been around probably 900 megahertz. It seems to work pretty well. And that one was recognized almost immediately with very little fooling around with SDR Sharp. There is a receiver, this is more for V and U, and you probably have to wrangle it with an up converter for HF. Is the AirSpy, and that one's a little bit more expensive. That's, I guess, around 120 or 130 bucks. But that one seems to be the most seamless and probably the highest performing I've fooled with of the less than crazy money SDRs. Back to that.
Why?
I'm gonna take one more thing.
Lou, NY2H recognized. And Bill, before we leave you, the one that you like, Bill, what's the model number, roughly how many dollars? Over to you, Bill.
Well, that's kind of the thing. It's, both of these devices are called generically RTL-SDRs. The one that worked for me was around $75 or $79. And it's sort of a little metal box. The picture of it is on there in Amazon. It has two SMAs on the top. One of them is marked UV, one is marked HF. And then it has says RTL SDR underneath. Has a little sort of spectrum display screened on it, and then the USB connection on the bottom. So that's the one I have. And again, it was about $75 or $79.
Okay, I'm going to go over to Eric and then Lou in that order. Eric, where he had trouble getting recognition to his computer on the first one. Wonder if you got some words on that. KE2EJ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
That's what I was going to mention, K2RW, K2J. You're having diver issues. It took a while for FTTI to become more of a rock-solid standard. There are different model numbers. Although they all say RTL-SDR, there's actually different chips inside them.
I can't remember. It was 2838. I don't remember the exact numbers, but the first line, they had a little bit of driver issues. Was that you loaded one driver, the computer thought it was something else, and then there was a conflict. Actually, the latest driver software that they have available for it figures it out and does it right. There is a couple of other places that you can go. You want to spend a little more money, go to Tapper. Tapper has a superb SDI system, which they sell, which you can build or buy. And there are a couple of other guys out there, that I think there's a German group that's got a little box like he was just mentioning, which goes down to HF and makes it up to the top. Pretty much what I wanted to say, K2RW, K2J.
Thank you, Eric. Don, good information. Now, Lou's the next guy who's going to give us some words. Well, you've been buying dongles like they're going out of style for the list. So when it comes to the right brand name for a guy to buy it, I bet you've got some good recommendations. NY2H, K2RW. Go ahead, Lou.
Sorry, Dick. It's NY2HF. It's Dennis in Cutchard. Put it back to you.
We still like hearing from you, Dennis. Sorry about that. If you've got information on this one, go right ahead, Dennis. And give us a little bit more audio if you can.
Give you much more audio. There's a little bit of interference. But what I would say is that you have to ask the person, first off, what operating system are they using on a computer. If they're using a Mac, they might want to go to SDR DX for free software. Dongles that are inside metal is actually an option to the normal ones. The normal ones are more susceptible to interference from the computer, and the metal ones actually, it's almost like a Faraday cage. Also, some of them come with a little antenna on the dongle, and some of them can hook up to normal antennas that hams use. So there's a great variety for what people want to experiment with. So you really got to start from the platform of what the computer is you're using and work from there. Back to net.
Actually, that's not completely true. Go right ahead, Eric. Give us some words on that.
There's software available for anything that you want. SDR Sharp is available to Windows. It's available to Mac. It's available as well. Exactly, it's written in C. So.
And if you want to compile your own version of it, you're welcome to. Anybody have any further comments before we pass it back to John? Give me a call, letters right now. John, your questioner, please let him know if he doesn't already know it. He's allowed to come back and ask the question multiple times, multiple ways, because when it comes to software-defined radios, which is now the brand new buzzword. When I go to any of my microwave update conferences, the attendees there are predicting that all of our radios are going to be software-defined in the very near future. So they're claiming you got to get on board that particular train because it's leaving the station real fast. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, you're absolutely right, Dick. Pretty soon, you probably won't buy the shack in the box. It'll be the little plug-in card. It'll be all over. Yeah, I have a couple of software-operated radios, and even they're amazing with all of the features they have. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one. They have a young amateur in Pennsylvania with a question. Has a similar tuner that I have, like the PALSTAR 400, which will actually give you values of corrections on a readout as it's tuning your antenna. What he'd like to know is, once it compensates for the deficiency of the antenna and it's matched, now if he takes those values, installs them at the antenna, now basically the antenna is 50 ohms perfect, what does the tuner do and why does it do anything? We now have a perfectly matched antenna. So maybe you can give him a rundown. Because what he's believing is it's set to compensate for the original error, so the tuner must be an error. What will it do? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
sky. If my antenna is less than an ideal termination for my particular transmission line, let's assume that my transmission